and welcome to the Neurodivergence and Mental Health Podcast. My name is Sally Nilsson, and I'm a psychotherapist, published author, public speaker, and mum. I discovered my autism and ADHD aged 56 in March 2021, and having rewritten my life story, I'm on a quest to advocate for neurodivergent community. I hope you enjoy listening to my incredible guests sharing their experiences of autism, ADHD, dyslexia, dyspraxia, dyscalculia, Tourette's and OCD. We talk about growing up, education, work and personal stories and how mental health has played its part in shaping lives. Our conversations cover spectrums, traits, challenges, acceptance and successes. So sit back, relax, and find out what it means to feel, think, and be different in a neurotypical world. Welcome to the Neurodivergence and Mental Health Podcast. I'm Sally Nilsson, and today I'm delighted to welcome Cora Burke, the neurodistinguished lawyer. I wanted to bring Cora onto the podcast as soon as I saw your new venture, NeuroRebellion. We'll be talking about this a bit later, but first, please introduce yourself in your own way, Cora, and tell our listeners about your unique neuro profile.
Hi, everyone. I'm Cora Burke. I'm 52. I live in Portsmouth with my dog, two cats, and I've been here since 2000. I'm Dutch national, came here to be with my partner who passed away 2 years ago. But I love it in the UK. I feel completely at home. I was diagnosed with ADHD as a child, but as you all know, you have to go through the whole rigmarole again when you're an adult. And at that stage, it was also discovered that I have autistic traits. I have dyspraxia, dyscalculia, and my working memory is absolutely shite. And, you know, you just have to sort of work your way around things, don't you? So, yeah, I've got a great team around me. And, yeah, I managed to do what I do. And that's me in a nutshell.
Oh, and thank you so much for telling me that. And please, you know, I am very sorry that you lost your partner. That's very sad and must have been very difficult. And when you talk about your fantastic team around you, my goodness, I could do with one. I'm teamless at the moment. It's just me. And we call it scaffolding, don't we? We do call it scaffolding. And it is essential, you know. I mean, we will move on, but I'm just so interested that you said that. Do you mind me asking, you know, what sort of scaffolding have you got? Who are these amazing people that are, you know, there for you?
Well, I've got Ollie, who is my legal assistant. He's also ND, and I have had him with me for, I think, 7 months now. He is my best friend's stepson. He lives with me. He's kind of my carer as well. So he's, you know, super important to me. And I decided to offer him a traineeship because I've trained up complete non-starters people who have not had any legal background before, administrators. And our mindset, our attention to detail, our hyperfixation is absolutely key to being in the legal profession. So I said, look, you know, you're interested. Why don't we give it a try? And he's handling his own contracts now. He's absolutely blimming brilliant. And he teaches me things. And that's the beauty about mentoring, because mentoring is about going on a journey together. And it's fantastic. And we have great fun as well. So that's Ollie.
That sounds absolutely perfect. And I know about that because that's like the psychotherapist and client relationship. Yeah. It's just not like it used to be when I was working with the predominant neurotype. You know, we go on a journey together. We share life experiences. We're honest and open. And when you do have that, it makes all the difference. It's, you know,
and you're reassuring him. Yeah. And then we have two law students, Ikra and Nazia, they're in their third year, I think. No, second or third year, can't quite remember. That's my working memory again. And Ollie is their manager, and they do our administration, they do social media. They're starting to get involved in some actual consultancy work. So, you know, they kind of keep me on the straight and narrow. And since 2 weeks, I also have a virtual assistant, which I have very kindly got via Access to Work. And Access to Work is absolutely amazing if you can get it. You know, when you have a disability, you can apply to Access to Work via DWP. It's just absolutely criminal to get through the process, but you know, consider it because you have an entitlement to it.
And also to get access to work, I mean, there's two things there that come up really. One of them is you must have done quite a lot to get your scaffolding for starters. So, and that I imagine that was probably very hard to do as well. That's why you needed it. And I see quite a lot of virtual assistants. It's such a booming area that's really, really important. And you know, and on that access to work, it's the same with so many things like assessment and all sorts of other things. It's absolutely essential. And I know, look, you can't see this at the moment, listeners. Cora has almost got her head in her hands, and she's shaking it. But she's shaking it because it is criminal. And I'm sure we're going to come on to that actually. So let's just have a look. Now, I'm doing it in a slightly different way because I really do want to hear about your work and Neuro Rebellion a lot. So I've just got a few little questions, if that's okay, just to attempt to keep it in the house style. And the first one is our community often share many big life experiences. And rather than do the sort of birth to school to university trip with you, I thought I'd do it a different way. Please, Cora, can you tell us three things that have happened to you that have been life-changing during your lived experience?
Absolutely. So, I have epilepsy. My birth was life-changing in the first place because I am the surviving half of twins. My sister and I tried to be born at 3.5 months, but you know, we were stopped from that, and that's when she died. But then at 6.5 months, I arrived in the world, and my dad was told that he could thank God on his bare knees that he still had a wife and a daughter. So that was a kind of life-changing experience. I shouldn't be here by all accounts, but I was born with epilepsy, and I learned later on in life that that was actually a neurodivergent condition. So it did affect me because I have brain damage. Back then it was called minimal brain damage, but nowadays it is called ADHD. And I had so many seizures all through my early childhood that the ADHD was ignored because the epilepsy was life-threatening. So at age 9, it was decided that I would benefit from being hospitalized in a specialist epilepsy clinic for a year. And it was absolutely horrendous to be separated from my parents because when at that tender age you're separated from your parents, you start to believe that you're not wanted.
Yes.
But the good thing was there was specialist education. And to have that care and that focus and that intentions on you and being told you're fine, you do fine, I think that was absolutely formative for me.
Yeah.
So despite the downsides of being away from home and having to rebuild that relationship with my parents, I believe that having that specialist education was absolutely fundamental for my, you know, further education. So I think that was, you know, proper life-changing for me.
And just on that, because of what you said before, and I hear what you say, that was life-changing. And because you know you are neurodivergent, you know, there's autism and ADHD, there's epilepsy there. And but still, just being a human being away from parents, you know, that we do hear about, you know, childhood trauma from naught to sort of the very early years, shaping people's lives very much. But it doesn't necessarily always do that. Can I just ask, because it's mental health as well, the podcast is, you know, Were you traumatized in any way? Did you ever feel that attachment, abandonment type of feeling from not having parents? And because you did say it was horrible being in the unit, what did you get as far as the nurturing side from there?
There was very little nurturing in the unit, and many, many years later, I realized that I had suffered abandonment and neglect, but that was because my mum suffered postnatal depression, and I have very vivid images, and I went through CBT, PTSD training, EMDR. I always switched those last letters, but I have a very clear image in my mind of standing at mum's bed and basically begging her to wake up because I was alone in the flat, no water, no food, nothing. And that may be a very triggering image, and I do apologize for that. Edit it out if you need be. But I have processed it and it's all fine now. But it was very difficult to work through abandonment trauma, back 2, 3 years ago in the middle of COVID. But
And oh, so you did work through it, and I'm
okay.
not going to edit anything. This podcast is real, and it's everything in it, absolutely, Cora. But so just you don't have to say anything, tell me anything. Of course, it's that it's not right. But you had 2 to 3 years of big sort of therapy during COVID. And do you think that that put things where they need to be as far as your experiences?
A great deal, yes, but the real settling came when I was diagnosed and I realized, do you know what? Mum was autistic.
Yeah.
Mum couldn't express herself, and Mum was done a great deal of disservice by the medical and social services because they ignored everything. She had problems with her hearing, and they said, no, it's all in your head. No, she had auditory processing disorder, just
Yes.
like I do. And
And
all of a sudden, everything falls into place.
yeah, incredible. It's incredible. Every day during the day, there's more things that come up that you sometimes too much, Cora, when the realizations we have. So that was one of your difficult experiences and a very, very big one. And what else has happened to you in your life?
Well, funnily enough, I had a meeting earlier today here in the office with someone who knows this person, but I was set on the path of reviewing and negotiating contracts by a great mentor of mine. His name is Mike Gawthorne, and he's the CEO of the Sericor Group. And I had just been made redundant from my in-practice job at the Dutch partner firm to Linklaters and Alliance. And, it was a bit of a shock to the system. And you start applying for jobs. And there was this job in a recruitment firm. I thought, never done recruitment. What do I do? And Mike saw something in me. And he encouraged me to start not only reviewing contracts, which was okay, fine, I can handle that. But then he said to me, a Dutch girl in an English firm, I want you to start negotiating contracts. And I went, what the hell? I have to do this complex thing in a language that's not my own. And he encouraged me and built me up. And, I will always be grateful to him for that because he completely gave me the courage to build myself up and to actually say, you know what, I can be a contracts manager. And that's what I am today. I'm a contracts and commercial professional. I've even gotten into intellectual property. And I swear blind, if it hadn't been for him, I wouldn't be where I am today professionally. So that was a life-changing event.
That is so interesting to hear, and negotiating. I just like we like to share things, and it's to concrete and understand. I was 15 years in sales, in publishing and exhibition management, and I did some estate agency, and I've been in recruitment as well. I don't know what it is, and I'm not, I don't want to generalize particularly, but I am a really good negotiator. And I think part of it, certainly for me, because I didn't know I was autistic until I was 56, is autism and ADHD, because we mirror, we build rapport, We're pattern matching detectives, and we do these things, and we're able to go backwards and forwards and to meet needs of another person. So we don't like a lot of salespeople or other people. They're just facts, facts, facts. They throw facts at you all the time, but they don't establish the need that needs to be met. And that's when negotiation comes in. It comes in when it's, so what are you really saying? So what is it you really want? And then it goes backwards and forwards. So, you know, when you built your skill as a negotiator, it must have been amazing. I mean, just tell me a little bit about how you grew like that.
Well, it was really difficult initially, the first couple of years, because they kept saying to me, you need to be more commercial. I come straight out of corporate practice. I work by the law. And they kept saying to me, you need to be more commercial. That doesn't compute. Tell me what it means.
Yes.
And then I had a breakdown. I was out for 3 months, came back on a stage, stage comeback, and my manager had changed. And I went to a fantastic operations director, and there was a legal manager in place now. And the operations director had a real feel for mental health, and the legal manager was a great guy, and I learned loads from him. And I settled back in, and it's like, okay, now I'm safe, you know. And
it's
you
about
know,
the people, though, isn't it, Cora? Because you know, the way where my brain's going at the moment is saying, my God, that could have gone a completely different way. You know, when you were just saying to me, I came back and I went in, and it was a different manager and you know, somebody else. Immediately, my brain's going, oh my God, Cora's going to tell me that, you know, they weren't very good. And when you then said to me, and they were fantastic and they were brilliant, you know, there's a lot to be grateful for that, isn't there?
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah. So yeah, you know, that was a great time. I was with the company for 9 years, and then there was a restructuring and there was a redundancy, and then I set up for myself.
And you know, that the strength, you know, resilience, sometimes people don't like the word resilience, but just a lot of it comes out of adversity. And for me, this is my own personal thing, adversity made me stronger, and there's no doubt about that. And so are you going to tell me about your third big life experience?
Yeah, and that's split into, and that's the two great loves of my life. I moved to the UK to be with my husband, Patrick, and that he basically saved me from an abusive relationship. So that was 7 years of abuse, and the first year and a half, 2 years, he didn't have it easy, really didn't, but he was patient with me. I was his carer for 20 years. He was a kidney patient, and, you know, it is what it is. My parents were worried about it because Dad had always cared for Mom, and he says, are you sure about this? And I said, Dad, I'm fine. And towards the end, it was hard because his kidney packed in, and it was in the middle of COVID, but, you know, it is what it is. And
it's a journey, and
it's a journey.
And however hard that journey, you know, if we have Joseph's multicolored dream coat on us and we look at the fabric of it, and some of it's silky and smooth, and other bits are fraying and falling off, and it's life. And
I
think we're pretty good at doing life, aren't we?
Yeah, absolutely. And in the end, you know, it was just a mercy for him to let go. I was with him. His family was with him. And, you know, it is what it is. So, and that's 2.5 years ago. And then towards September, October, I was really, really at my wit's end with the whole diagnosis process, getting my medication. I was literally teetering on the brink. And then I met my current partner, and, you know, he's a widower and he has a little boy, and we were both at the end of our wits. But, you know, for some reason, divine providence brought us together. We don't see each other very often because he's in the US. He's an army man. He's currently deployed, but he makes me very, very happy. And he's teasing out the final barbs of all the abuse, and he's an absolute godsend.
I'm so happy. I'm so happy for you. That's wonderful. That is, that's a lovely part of that story that
yeah.
definitely had its ups and downs. And absence makes up growth.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
Excuse me, I'm sorry about that. So I love what you say, you know, because I've had a look around you on LinkedIn and websites, what have you. And I love what you say about how you succeeded in getting where you are today by not taking the conventional route. So what did you take as far as education and work are concerned?
Oh, that's very interesting. I mean, like in the UK, you have your 11 plus and all that. And in the US, they have their SATs and what have you. We have a CETO test, or at least when I was there. And that indicated I could all either go to special education or vocational education. And I went, I want to use my hand, we'll go to vocational education. And I did that. And somewhere in the third year, all of a sudden, my brain switched on and I started achieving. And towards the end of that, I had extremely high marks in English and reasonably good marks in other languages, absolutely rubbish marks in maths.
Maths! Ah!
Oh, I am so crap at maths, it's unreal.
Me too.
And so it was decided that I would go through to what is here the equivalent of a sixth form college. And again, that trend continued, and I actually graduated ahead of everybody else in time, a full 6 months early, with the highest marks in my year.
Wow.
I know, my parents were really proud.
I bet they were.
And then I chose the wrong studies to follow up, and it was a combination between library academies, because I love that whole categorization, the Jewish system.
Oh, yes.
But it also had a business component. Far too much maths, didn't work. So switched over with career advice to doing English as secondary or teaching as a foreign language.
Yes.
That really worked very, very well. But my mom fell ill. She came down, that's not really the word to use, but she was diagnosed with ME.
Oh,
and
yes.
that caused so much overwhelm and distress that I just couldn't pull it. I all the academic subjects I finished, but it affected my ability to actually teach. So I failed two teaching practices. And in the end, you know, I said, look, I need to go and work. I can't keep doing this. I can't keep failing because it's crippling me emotionally. So I finished 89% of the degree. I have all the sort of theory, the pedagogic theory. I have obviously the English skills, and that was it. And I started working as a legal secretary, and I guess that's where my basis in law comes from. And then after the 7 years of misery with my ex, I met my late husband, and he proposed to me in 3 days. I said yes, and the rest, as they say, is history.
It is. And were you caring for your mum as well?
Yeah, I was a child carer.
And I mean, that's a whole podcast on its own. And I have an interest, a very big interest. I mean, this, you know, I'm not going to go into one on this, but definitely with ME, fibromyalgia, all the different physical ailments that come with neurodiverse people, autoimmune, even cancer, eye problems, so many different problems. And I mean, I've only been studying massively for 2 years, but I feel like I've done a 2-year degree, because it's when I have a special interest. And like all of us, you know, nobody can really understand what it means to have a special interest, and with ADHD as well, having the hyper focus. So I've learned a lot. And this is something that I will, you know, I'm only a spring chicken. I'm coming up for 58. And so I've got a good 10 years left in me before whatever happens, happens. So I want to learn so many different things. So thank you for telling me about that. Something that popped up that I was very, very interested to ask you about, Cora, is in the workplace, mm-hmm.
you know, because I've had lots of jobs and quite and lots of sales jobs and lots of bosses and lots of bullying and everything. But I'm quite a tough geezer bird. You know, people use the word non-binary a lot. I quite like the word geezer bird because it comes back from the 80s, where I grew up in. That's me. But there were horrible bosses. There definitely were. And the question is, you know, why do you think so many people are fearful of disclosing their neurotypes in the workplace? And why does fear-based leadership not work?
Okay, it's two questions. Starting with the fear-based leadership, if you have to rely on scaring people in order to submit them to your will, then you're not a leader. You might be a manager, and managing can be learned, but you're not a leader. If you want to be a leader, you have to bring people with you. You have to be first among equals. You have to support people. You have to nourish them. I have seen both leaders, thankfully, but I've also seen more recently people who just inspire fear and terror, and they will cut you down at least things. People that will withhold promotions from you on account of your communication style. People that will not communicate directly, but will yap behind your back against your managers, and then your managers have to grovel to you. It's like, no, sorry, that's not how you do things. There are policies and procedures and processes, and you think you're above them. So if as a already vulnerable employee, you know that you can't rely on the policies and procedures and processes that are there because you have a terror, a tyrant of a leader at the top, that's why you don't disclose.
Absolutely.
And it is wrong. And that's why I started Neuro Rebellion, because the Equality Act 2010 guarantees us protection from discrimination, victimization, and harassment and bullying, because authorities like, you know, local councils, the government, and et cetera, and private organizations must not discriminate against us on account of any disabilities or long-term health conditions. And they must make reasonable adjustments for us in their hiring processes, in their policies, procedures, et cetera, if they know or if they can reasonably suspect that we have these disabilities and conditions. The fact that they don't is neither here nor there. We have a right to hold them to account. And if we do hold them to account and they subsequently victimize us against us, we take them to the cleaners. That's what I do. And I'm sick and tired of it not being done.
So, I mean, it's, you know, I'm floored by that bit, really, because in the 15 years I worked, nobody had the memo. It was dog eat dog. It was being thrown to the lions. There was favoritism. I had, because I was undiagnosed. So the favoritism was awful. There was rejection sensitivity dysphoria. You know, there was downright bullying, you know, and because many of us are big on justice and fairness and hierarchies. So for me, hierarchy doesn't exist. And that's interesting what you say, actually, because my last job I was in for 6 years, which is a long job for me, the leader wasn't a leader. So, and that was a good thing, because funnily enough, I stayed longer at that job than any other, because we all worked together and it was much more equal. And you've just made a penny drop for me by saying what you've said, because I had been at other companies where it was leader that you were terrified of, and it was horrible. And we're going to come on to this in more detail. So Frascati Associates, just give me a little bit around, you know, the different parts of Frascati Associates. You know, how long has it been developed? And just tell me a bit about that. And then we're going to talk about Neuro Rebellion.
Okay, so it's a group now. It's Frascati Associates Group. Yep. Frascati Associates Limited has been in operation since November 2020. Started it while it was still working in research and academia, and that's where the name Frascati comes from, because of the Frascati definition of research. And please don't ask me to recite that because of my shite working memory.
Yes, okay.
You can look it up on Google.
But,
primary target area is working with academics, researchers, and innovators. Collaborative contracting is really a great way of working, because whereas I worked previously in corporate contracting, it's really a dog eat dog world, and you know, someone has to be always right and someone always has to gain something. And whereas in collaborative contracting, you come together, either two parties or a whole consortium of parties, and you look at the community interest. How can what we do benefit the public? So you all agree on a common goal, and you basically say, right, okay, we may have some intellectual property here. Are we going to share that, or how are we going to deal with that? And money is not necessarily the objective. Of course, you have to fund the outcome, but yeah, you're not going to, it's not combative, it's collaborative. And that was such an eye opener for me, Sally, because when I first came to academic contracting, I would sit there with my red pen going eagerly, no, that's not right. Yeah. And I was talking, don't worry about it. We don't worry too much about risk. We don't worry too much about indemnities. I went, you what? And then you get that whole, we're all in the same boat. We're collaborating. And it's such a metaphor for society and what society should be.
I just haven't had that. And as an autistic person, honestly, we're all complete paradoxes. You know, we love one thing, we don't love another. And I have had so many problems in groups and meetings, and nobody sort of being part of it. And I see this in my tribe. I see this in my neuro tribe. I see it on LinkedIn, and everybody wants, and that in itself is a community. And I am, you know, sometimes I think I'm a communist, but really I think I'm probably more the equivalent of, you know, a communityist, you know. But groups are still difficult for me. I like to be on the edge. I like to be ideas. So I'll come in and go, idea. Right, I'll get my coat. because that's just kind of, you know, how I like to do things. But for you to be in that environment is amazing.
It is. It's fantastic. And it's not the sole focus. I mean, I love working with innovators. I had someone talking yesterday about an idea that could really benefit our community. And it's like, right, okay, well, let's protect it. Don't talk to anyone about it, because as soon as you talk about an idea without any protection, you can't patent it anymore. And I love taking an idea with an innovator and just help them nurture it and bringing it to commercial fruition. It's beautiful. Absolutely love it. Love working with techies and scientists. You know, my boy's an engineer. I love engineers. And this is how my mind works. I have an engineer's mind. You start with the desired outcome and then you reverse engineer it. And it's fantastic.
And that makes, and it, you know, it's so fantastic when you say that, for me to think of a neurodivergent team. Because within that team, because we are so different, just, you know, we're so different, you know, dyslexia brings the bigger picture and 3D modeling, you know, dyspraxia, don't bump into tables. No, I'm having a joke there. But, you know, each and every one of us has something to bring to the table. So my ideas would be really good. I can put it on the whiteboard. I can build something. But then I want to hand it over, and you're reverse engineering. And then I'm not keen on terms like disruptors, entrepreneurs, and side hustles. It makes me vomit. Mm. But the idea behind it is good. So if you say entrepreneurial thinking, I'm with you. That thing about looking outside the box, well, we don't have boxes. Boxes don't exist anyway. You know, we're way out from the boxes and things. So I'd love you to tell me about Neuro Rebellion. And, you know, I'm a small placard waver, and fairness and justice runs absolutely through my core. If I think something's unjust has happened to someone or a minority group of people, I have to do something about it. And I can't rest until I have. So you have someone here who would march to Westminster and take action around neurodiversity and human rights. Good. I've been wanting to find something like this, because I was there with Brexit. I was there with refugees, you know, and I've done sort of some other things in a small way, but it's enough for me. So please tell us a bit more about Neuro Rebellion, because I don't know anybody else like you. What do you want to do with it, and who can join, and when's our first march?
Okay. So Neuro Rebellion is really a gut anger response to all the injustice that I see in my practice day in, day out. And when I see people posting about their child being excluded from school, or someone, God forbid, dying in a clinic, or killing themselves out of despair. And God knows I've been close to it myself, and it is wrong, and I'm tired of it. So I mentioned earlier, the Equality Act is there to protect it, but people keep just trampling over it, and I'm sick and tired on it. So there are 5 action points I want to see. Access to healthcare, better than the 3 to 7 years waiting list that we have now. I want access to education, and all of it has to be accessible and inclusive. So I want properly funded SENCOs in schools. I don't want to see any more automated, your child has not been to school for 75 days or whatever, because that's just financial punishment and stress to parents who are doing their bloody best already. I want to see proper housing, access to housing for people. I want to see proper access to gainful employment, and I want to see proper, accessible and inclusive justice, because there is plenty of reports on neurodivergence in the criminal justice sector. I mean, up to 80% of people currently in jail are considered to be neurodivergent. What the hell? But there is nothing in the civil justice. And if we just start at the beginning and actually diagnose and treat people and help people, then they're not going to end up in jail.
Exactly. And I had Sarah Templeton from Heads Up ADHD.
Yeah.
And she also had a colleague of hers that worked in the prison system, which she did as well. She gave me that stat of 80%. And I mean, I was incredibly interested in about it, about autistic people who, you know, they don't sometimes, it's not that they don't understand, they have a different way of being, and they find themselves by perhaps doing something inappropriate, or they do something, they end up in the prison system, and then they kill themselves in prison. And we've got to, I believe, we've got to go right back to basics, and that's parents and recognizing neurodivergence and starting right from the beginning, because I know that medication is good and I know it's necessary and I know some people can't live without it. But my question will always be, in the bigger picture, we shouldn't need it anyway, because we should be in a society where there is inclusion and people understand and that we can look out for people who are a bit different right from the get-go. But everything at the moment in this country is falling apart. And for neurodiversity, it's coming quite a long way down. And I watched the 4-hour, or listened to the 4-hour, well, I did watch actually, I watched the 4-hour debate on Parliament TV about assessment and diagnosis for ADHD. And I tell you, Cora, it was hopeful. There are some incredible people. There were 15 MPs there, and they are doing their damnedest. And it's got to be a multi-pronged approach, but it's also got to be, you can hear my passion, you know, it has to be people like us who are not scared of banging the drum, being honest, being blunt, and saying what needs to be said. Things have got to change. So people like Sadiq Khan is trying hard for dyslexia, other neurodiversities. Our government, I can't even go there, but I'm hopeful with Keir, because I'm hearing other things around, friends who work with government, and it's looking hopeful. And I'm there with you, and lots of other people will be too. And I really want you to put those links in. And it leads to on, really, Cora. You know, I host this podcast just to give neurodivergent people a platform to share life experiences and to share knowledge and give support. And for you, with everything that, where you've come from, what you've done, your life experiences, everything, What would be your key message to all our listeners about how we can support our neurodiverse community at home, in the education system, at work and beyond?
Be fearless. Fear is the mind killer. And I know I'm quoting June there, but it's true. Fear, as you well know, is a biological response. It is your brain coming back from very, very early existence, and you have to fight through it because fear is temporary. There's always a logical response to fear. And I know that your whole body seizes up in whether it's your fight response, your flight response, freeze or fawn, but you've got to break through it. There is always another day. The sun will rise again, and we have got to stand up and we have to stand together. We are 11 million in the UK alone, and we have to stand together and support each other because it's not going to come from the neurotypical community. We, as neurodivergents, have to support each other because only we understand how we operate. And I promise you, the community is there. My business partner, Shah Siddiqui, and I are working together to create an app. It's going to be maybe 3 months before we launch it. And it's going to offer a community to us as neurodivergent people to liaise with each other, to talk to each other, to just share experiences. But on the other side, it's also going to have a marketplace for us to directly engage with service providers. So whether that's you, Sally, or whether it's someone like Sarah Templeton or a assessor or like someone like Mandy Wally, who does the empowerment passport, or anyone else who provides services that we need, we will vet them. We're not going to go for, oh, like you have invested in people or disability confidence. I don't give a shit. I want to know that you are trauma-informed and that you're neurodivergent informed. And that whole platform, I honestly believe it's going to make a difference for us. And it will also have some features that are very, very helpful for us as neurodivergent people. But I can't yet disclose that because it's proprietary technology, but it's going to be awesome because my business partner, Shah, is awesome. He's from Time Research and Innovation. Fantastic company.
And that's, I can't wait to find out more about that. And that is going to be essential and just so important. And I, and what you said before, Cora, about fear and anxiety. Now, I'm so interested. Oh, I hate that expression, so. And now it's in my head. I can't stop saying it. I am very interested in the evolution of psychiatry. And there's an amazing book around it that I want to get. And I've spoken to the editor and writer of that publication. And I absolutely believe that fear and anxiety is a positive thing. It's a needed thing, and we do need it. But a lot of it is social norms, conformity, and all of that. And it's conditioning, it's learned behavior through time that have made us think we're scared, and because somebody else said that, we've got to do that. But it's really important. It's there for a reason, and it's the same as depression, which I see as deep rest. So yes, when we go through a layering up of chronic stress and anxiety and everything else and trauma, we get to the point of burnout, and then we call it depression. But what it means is that we need to rest. And because we're not allowed to rest, we get ME, we get autoimmune diseases and inflammation and everything else. And there's so much more to learn around that. But these feelings we have, as a psychotherapist, I work with clients on in a somatic way as well, because they internalize and their feelings go in and create IBS and different things. Oh, so it's feeling the feelings is very important.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to have you on the podcast again another time, because I think there's so much to talk about, and I'm not in the market for just having lots and lots of guests. I'm doing 3 series and then I'll leave it again. And the likelihood is I'll bring back my guests because these are my big interest, and there's a reason for wanting to talk to you. So it leaves me to say, Cora, thank you so much. This has been absolutely fascinating and really important information. Great talking to you. So thank you, and absolutely the best wishes for everything that's coming ahead. So thank you once again.
Really enjoyed it. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye, Cora.
Bye.
Thank you very much for listening to the Neurodivergence and Mental Health podcast. Links and resources will be at the end in the show notes. I very much look forward to meeting you again. Thanks for listening. Bye.